what it means to be compassionate. The University of Southern Maine recently opened a new Center for Compassion aimed at deepening compassion at the university and in the greater community. But what does that mean exactly? How does compassion manifest itself in everyday action? And how does compassion differ from empathy? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Compassion is becoming a greater focus of scientific research relating to sociology, psychology, health, and economics. According to those who study compassion, it can be a powerful tool for both personal growth and societal transformation. The practice of compassion has been harnessed in schools, churches, workplaces, and more. And many say we need more of it in today's world. What does it mean in your life? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. We're in the season of giving thanks. Tomorrow is Giving Tuesday, and with the holidays ahead, we felt it was a good time to talk about compassion. What does it mean to be compassionate? And can you foster compassion in yourself and in others? We will learn more about that today. Joining me in the studio, Vaishali Momgain. She is Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Southern Maine, where she is also Director of USM's Center for Compassion. Sarah Ewing Merrill is co-pastor of Hope Gateway Church in Portland. She also serves as executive director and co-founder of Greater Portland Family Promise, which addresses the needs of families experiencing homelessness. And Penthea Burns is senior associate at the Cutler Institute and Muskie School of Public Service at the University of Southern Maine. She works with Children, Youth, and Families Program. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you ever benefited from someone else being compassionate towards you? Are you concerned that there's a lack of compassion in our society today? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Vaishali, I want to start with you because I understand that the Center for Compassion at the University of Southern Maine is new. How new?
Oh, very new. We just started this year, and it was started by a gift from an anonymous donor who heard Dr. James Doty, who is the director for the Stanford Center for Compassion and Altruism Research. And this person was he was talking at UNE, and this person was in the audience, and they felt so inspired at the role that compassion can play and how at a university it can be center stage. So they gave some seed funding to us to start the Bertha Crosley Ball Center for Compassion.
And you're the new director. What do you hope to do with this responsibility, this center now?
You know, it's such a privilege and an honor to serve in this role, because even when we just started, people from the university, people from the community have reached out to us and said, oh my God, there's such a need for this, and how can we be connected? How can we help? And our mission at the center is to do two things. One is to offer trainings to deepen people's compassion. Actually, this is something, a compassion's a muscle that you can train. And the other part is to reach out to people in the university community, in society, who are doing amazing work, like my two friends here, Penthea and Sarah, and see how we can support each other. So that's the mission of the center.
Okay, great. And you mentioned James Doty. He was also on Maine Calling when he was here in Maine. I want to turn to each of you and ask you, I'll start with you, Penthea. When someone says the word compassion, what does it mean to you? I mean, I think that we have this assumption of a shared definition, but as you start to think harder about that word, what does it even mean?
That's a great question. I've been thinking about it a lot, of course. And for me, part of what compassion means is that what happens to you matters to me.
So it's not just empathy, where you can put yourself in someone else's shoes, but that it matters.
Yeah, yeah, and that I have a stake in that. And that, I mean, it extends not just between people, but the beings of this planet and the very planet itself, that we belong to this planet as opposed to the planet being a commodity or other animals as well. It's a kind of intimacy with life itself, and really a sense of interdependence, interreliance, interrelationship.
Okay, and turning to you, Sarah, how does the idea of compassion, the meaning of compassion, manifest itself in what you do every day?
I think compassion is really at the center of what I do in both of my spheres of work. And some of that is because both of those spheres are filled with such diversity of people, recently arriving immigrants and LGBTQ people. And really to be part of compassion is to see who's vulnerable, like who is vulnerable in our society, who's vulnerable in the current sphere that I'm acting in, and to put my heart with their heart and to see through the eyes of love and that every person is a beloved child of God. And that if someone is vulnerable, then it's not so much about fixing that situation, but about placing my heart with their heart. And something I, you know, have come to say just in the past few years is to people of all different walks and beliefs and like, my heart is with yours. And to just say my heart is with yours is to say more than I'm praying for you or I think you're important, but that you and I care about the same thing. And maybe that's that I care about you, or maybe that's that I care about some injustice that we're both aware of, but that when I place my heart with yours, then we're suffering with each other, which is the base of the word compassion. Mm-hmm.
The work that you do, though, often involves more than a feeling of compassion or expressing compassion, but also action. And it seems to me, Sarah, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, that social justice is an important component for you.
Yes, definitely. And I think when we encounter one another, I think through Family Promise, we have 700 volunteers in our network, and they 365 days a year, they share dinner together. Not all of those volunteers, but each night, two or three or four volunteers share with up to 14 guests in our program. They sit at a table together with a feast that somebody has made, and they share conversation. And those people are immigrants from Africa who are fleeing violence. Those people are American families who have found themselves in the vulnerable place of being homeless, losing all the stability in their life. And they're people that have never experienced any of that who are volunteers. And they come and they connect with people with a very different life experience. And those strangers become friends. And those people who would never have encountered each other connect in a real deep, meaningful way because they're sharing the table together and they're sharing food. And so their hearts are joined in that experience.
Sarah, several times while you were speaking, Penthea, you were nodding in agreement with the action part of this conversation.
Yeah, I was so appreciating you asking that question because I think it that compassion is more than a concept or an idea. It requires act and requires us to be in movement and doing something in order for compassion to really come alive. It's a contradiction to so much that has sort of contributed to the structures and systems of our society that, you know, we're built on competition and consumption and this myth of scarcity and that compassion is generous and it is. You used the word empathy earlier. Empathy, I think, is a strategy for exhibiting compassion. And rather than it being me understanding how you feel, it's more me abiding with you with such a warmth of presence that you have an opportunity to connect more fully with what you're experiencing. And it's less important that I really understand that, but that I abide with you in that kind of way.
I want to come back to you, Vaishali, because you're an economist. You know, it's not a surprise to me that Sarah, who is a pastor, has thought a lot about compassion. But what does compassion have to do with economics?
Very good question, because I think we are, you've got to go where the challenge is. Venthia just said, you know, a worldview of scarcity, which some can drive us to feel alone and then thus less compassionate. And unfortunately, that worldview of scarcity is sometimes systematized in economic theory. Mm-hmm. And it's not that I bought into it, because I actually grew up in India, very different place from here. But the reason I got involved and interested is because my research focused on refugees in Portland. And I, being an economist, did all this data work. I sent it off to be published. And the editor wrote back and said, the data work is fantastic. Your model's amazing. But have you actually spoken to anyone? And I was stumped, because I wasn't trained in graduate school to actually have these very difficult conversations, the kind that Sarah's describing. And so once I actually started interviewing refugees, and I wanted a very direct labor market question answered. What job did you get? How much did it pay you? And here I was hearing people's life stories. I realized the only way, the only training I had was my meditation practice of actually being present and bearing witness. And this goes back to what Sarah was saying, just saying my heart is with your heart, and not coming from a place of knowing, because how could, as Penthea said, you know somebody else's pain, but to just say, I am just bearing witness. And so that's when I realized this is so important for us to teach ourselves and our students, because sometimes the best we can do for another human being is simply to bear witness.
Is it part of the conversation about compassion right now also about self-compassion?
Oh, very good, Jennifer. Yes, you've hit it out of the ballpark. Yes, absolutely. And this is kind of shocking to most of us, but part of the reason that we actually don't fall into our hearts as much as we would like to is because we are so tough on ourselves. We don't have a whole lot of self-compassion. So when we actually engage in what is called the compassion cultivation protocol, the first thing we start with is acknowledging that we are vulnerable and may need help and may need compassion. And from that, unless we can give ourselves, and self-compassion is not self-indulgence. It's actually bearing witness to our own selves. Because if we're not present to ourselves, we can't be present to another human being.
It also strikes me that it's an act of resistance to this the kind of pace of life that we live in now that has us doing and moving and going from one thing to the next, and that compassion really requires us to build in space in our days where we pause and have a chance to even think, like, what's happening in my body? What am I thinking? What am I feeling? And that's not, it's not a transaction. It really requires us to have some kind of capacity to even trust looking within. And that is a slowing down from the way that we tend to live our lives in this society.
I understand that compassion, there's been a lot of research about compassion and happiness, about compassion and success. I'm going to throw this out to any of you. What do you think is the most meaningful research? What is the thing that you tell people and they say, really? You're smiling, Vaishali, so I'm going back to you.
Well, you know, I can read off to you. Compassion actually, yes, increases a whole lot of health benefits, mental health, physical health. It actually, the thing that to me is the most sort of mundane, duh kind of thing, is that compassion increases pro-sociality, that it increases our desire to help other people. And the research that they're doing is so fantastic. Like the simple thing, like James Cohen at University of Virginia, he invites people to come into his lab and couples and hold hands while looking at a mountain, and they're wearing heavy backpacks, and then they have to list how heavy is the backpack, how high is the mountain. And what you find, of course, is that people who are holding hands with their partner think the mountain is lower and the backpack is lighter than people who are viewing this alone. Mm. So what to me was striking when I was hearing Dr. Cohen, he said, I told this research to my mother and she said, why are you getting so much attention for it? It's obvious that when you are holding hands or are in relation, things feel easier.
Sarah, the groups that you serve are often groups who are at the opposite end, not compassion. Groups that are talked down to, debated in the public sphere with certain words and assumptions that are not positive. Do you feel as though there is a lack of compassion in our society today, and do you think it's growing?
I think that the voice is pretty strong against compassion in our society, and the judgment of others is kind of the default, that there's an enemy. We need a common enemy, and we have to name who that is. But it's not true. there is no common enemy, and the voices out there telling us that somebody else is to blame for our problems really demean all of us. But it is a voice out there. And I do feel like there is a percentage of the population that are buying into that, and that there's enough fear and vulnerability that we ourselves each feel that we sort of, you know, we look to an authority to tell us how to fix that. And so there's definitely, I don't know if it's growing, but it's a strong percentage of people in our society and in our country and in our state who find it easier to blame other people and to judge other people. But I do think that there is also a movement of people who have come to see that we are actually one world, and that each person is not that different from themselves. And I think we're more likely to see that if we actually have opportunities to interact and to learn and to grow, you know, as Maya Angelou says, like, know more, like, do better. Like, know better, do better. If you know, if you can learn that other people are not actually, you know, like, immigrants are not coming to destroy our society. Actually, our society is built on that whole premise, and we've come this far thanks to immigrants. And so there's definitely competing voices out there, and my hopefulness is that actually in the end, love wins, and compassion is stronger than fear.
Mm. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Maine Health Cancer Care Network. World-class cancer care right here in the place that gives strength, home. And the law offices of Joe Bornstein, a statewide practice representing injured and disabled Mainers since 1974. JoeBornstein.com.
Hello, I'm Mark Vogelsang, President and CEO of Maine Public. This Giving Tuesday, I hope you'll take a moment to support nonprofit organizations that matter to you. And of course, I hope you'll count Maine Public Radio as one of them. Our entire state relies on having an independent public radio broadcaster to educate and be a trusted source of NPR news. So if you can, join me in supporting this essential broadcast service on Giving Tuesday by making a donation at mainepublic.org.
Once again this year, our Maine Public Classical Holiday Stream is up and running and will continue until mid-January, providing a quality, commercial-free, public radio-style 24/7 holiday online stream of the many wonderful sounds and diverse interpretations that make up the well-known and not-so-well-known sounds of the holidays. The Maine Public Classical Holiday Service is available on the Maine Public app or online at our website, mainepublic.org. Just click on radio and listen live. It's one of the choices. And enjoy whenever and wherever you choose.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Fostering Compassion. Joining me in the studio, Sarah Ewing Merrill, co-pastor of Hope Gateway Church and executive director of Greater Portland Family Promise. Penthea Burns, senior policy associate at USM's Children, Youth, and Families Program. And Vaishali Momgain, director of USM's Center for Compassion. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before the break, Sarah and I were talking, or Sarah was talking about this idea that there's a common enemy out there, and that that is one of the forces against compassion in our world. Penthea, I know you wanted to jump in, but we had to go to a break, so go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Jennifer. You know, I much like compassion on an individual basis necessitates me to start with myself and understand myself. I think society-wide, we have the same challenge that ends up looking like we are identifying external enemies, but really it is a burden, an internal burden that we have as a society. Like the original founding of this country was founded on the stealing of this land, the genocide of Native peoples,
yes.
And that, you know, we might today be targeting some people as an enemy and invisibilizing others, Native people really being forced into the shadows. And I think part of what we have, this collective wound that we have, requires us to understand better who we are as a people and who we could be. And that would undercut that need for there to be an enemy when we are tending to really what is an internal wound in this society.
Joining me on the line now, Kimberly Post. She is with St. Joseph's College, where she is community-based learning director and engagement coordinator for the Center for Sustainable Communities. Thanks for calling in, Kimberly.
Hello. How are you today?
Good. I understand St. Joseph's is putting emphasis on compassion in the curriculum. How do you go about teaching compassion to students and faculty?
Well, we use community-based learning here at the college. This is a pretty institutionalized practice for us. And it's an instructional strategy that engages students in solving problems within their schools and communities. And it teaches tolerance, leadership, and civic and social responsibility, while reinforcing the core values of the college. And one of our main core values is compassion. And so because of this kind of learning, students do learn that it's important to be catalysts for social justice and to ensure that all human beings are treated respectfully and equally.
How do you assess whether people are learning to be more compassionate?
Oh, very good question. An integral part of community-based learning is the reflective process, where students do different activities from writing to presenting to deep thinking about the experiences that they've had. And reflective practice not only encourages self-examination and also examination of sense of place, but it helps to build capacities such as connection, empathy, compassion, and resilience.
Do you have hope that we can become a more compassionate society based on your work at St. Joseph's?
Oh, I always have hope, indeed. I think that the more that we engage our students with their communities and the more our students have these kinds of learning experiences, it will prepare them to be not just skilled in their fields, but more compassionate citizens of the world.
Well, thanks for calling in. Kimberly Post, Community-Based Learning Director for St. Joseph's College. We'll go now to Greg, who's calling from Kennebunk. Hi, Greg. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. And I think it's quite timely, your panel's discussion at this time, and I greatly commend you all for tackling it. But I've been a physician for over 30 years, practicing here in Maine over 20 in a hospital setting, and I struggle with the idea of how to encourage and nurture compassion. And many of us are not necessarily suited for what would, in many spiritual traditions, would be considered a lifetime or a series of lifetimes endeavors. But that said, to aspire to it is wonderful. Could we not be more focused and practical and encouraging more kindness in our actions and more civility, or what used to be called common courtesy when I was being raised, that's not so common anymore? Those are actually very practical approaches of an awareness or a mindful awareness of what we can do on a moment-to-moment basis in recognizing that those around us are present and are worthy of our attention.
Hi, Shelley.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for calling in. So, you know, you've hit the nail on the head, really, because compassion practice, so compassion is not that different from the things you're describing. Kindness, civility, being present to the people on a day-to-day basis, these are what we would call sort of the touchstones of compassionate behavior. And I want to make a distinction. One is that in the research that's unfolding around compassion science, it is really clear that repetition is key. Like any neural business that we attend to, neurons that fire together wire together. So the kind of things you're describing, small acts of compassion, small acts of kindness and civility, actually wire our brain to be kinder and more civil. So there is no denying that. And then I want to come back to the part that you said. You mentioned you're in the caring professions, and this is where we see in healthcare and in educators, we see such a high rate of burnout because folks go into these professions because they feel they have a calling and their heart is really tender. And there's nothing in the training that actually allows that tender heart to be sustained. So one of the things that is emerging is that there's a distinction between compassion and empathy from a neuroscience perspective. Compassion is how Sarah described it. It is the idea of feeling with someone, and empathy is the part where you might feel so much as someone else that one gets burnt out. And very unfortunately, this is what a lot of us suffer from when we actually feel a lot. It's empathic fatigue. It's known as, you know, it's dubbed compassion fatigue. But really, the part of the brain that lights up when doing compassion is there's an active part to it, and it's the left prefrontal cortex that lights up is a positive thing. So compassion is a virtual, very virtuous cycle. And that's part of what we are trying to do at the center, and Stanford is doing at Stanford and UC Berkeley, is we're actually training folks and saying, let's simulate this. When we get to the edge of empathic distress, we want to stop. And as Penthea, my co-panelist said, you check in with ourselves and we say, okay, where am I with this? What am I feeling? Am I feeling fear? Am I actually able to attend? And if I'm not, I need to step out and take care of what's happening for me. And that's also a part of the larger picture of compassion. So,
Greg, thank you for your call. We'll move on to Fred, who's calling from Tenants Harbor. Hi, Fred. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you so much. Great program. I'm glad to hear the word love mentioned in this program. I am certainly working to rehabilitate myself and whoever around me is open to learning and feeling more in that direction. My wife and I are graduates, teachers and students to each other in this area, and I'm making progress, so we are making progress. And thank you so much for the program. It's what can I say? It's the real thing.
Fred, thanks for calling in. Sarah, is compassion another word for love?
Yes. I think in the words of Christian scripture, seeing with the eyes of your heart, like, is compassion, is the idea of compassion and love being combined? And, you know, this idea that everybody is doing the best that they can, including me. And sometimes that's not, I don't feel like it's that good. But in the moment, I want people to believe that I'm doing the best that I can. And so I have to believe that other people are also doing the best that they can. And that doesn't mean we're all doing great. It just means that we're trying. Everybody's trying, and we're all failing in each and every moment. But if I can see, if I want people to have compassion for me and the places that I fail in my life, then I have to have compassion for the people that are failing in their lives. And that's love. And assuming positive intent, you know, like talking about with your spouse, like the caller was talking about, like, if I believe that nobody's out to attack me, especially my spouse, is not like doing something just for the whole sole purpose of driving me crazy, that actually there's a different reason that they are doing this thing that I wish that they wouldn't do. But that we, you know, I think that when we don't assume positive intent, then it's really hard to be loving towards each other because we feel like we're being attacked. But most of the time, I think people are trying to do the best that they can.
I'm also a student of nonviolent communication, and part of what you're talking about, Sarah, is, you know, something might happen in an interaction with another person that stimulates me. Well, that's mine. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, part of compassion is like me having 100% responsibility for what's happening in me. It's not your fault that I might be having a reaction to something that you are saying or doing. So again, if I can start with some curiosity about what's happening internally,
that's a great word, curiosity.
really listening. When I think about love, and I think compassion is love with listening and seeing people for who they are, and also then recognizing that, oh wow, that's mine, that's not yours, and what does that mean? And having some compassion for myself and patience that, you know, I might be short some days.
Jason on Facebook writes, compassion, nice topic for a country that is gassing refugees on our borders. Mm. The hypocrisy. We're the ones that insist we are a Christian nation are also supporting the gassing of refugees at our southern border. Compassion, where the poor and unfortunate are vilified for existing. And Vaishali, I want to return to something you were saying before, but from a different angle, which is if you watch the news, it's easy to be overwhelmed.
Mm. Yes.
And it's easy. What did you call it?
Empathic distress.
Empathic distress.
Yeah. And I know this is going to sound odd coming from a news program, but I very much think people shouldn't watch too much news. This idea of feeling overwhelmed, we don't need neuroscientific studies to support it. We just have to check in with our heart and we check in with our bodies. And we know many of us feel shut down when we see things like, is it Jason who mentioned on Facebook? And when that happens, when we see that happening, we also have to see what is our responsibility. And, you know, as Penthea pointed out, I think one of the things we don't do is we don't actually stop and say for a minute, oh my gosh, this is happening. And I just want to sit down and bear witness to how awful this must be for the mothers and the children and the young people. And just be with that, because it is painful. And so if we're not doing that, when we do that, our brains have a way of actually being able to center back in and see what it is we need. There's now entire mountains of neuroscientific research which says if you keep exposing yourself to bad news, bad news, bad news, actually your ability to be compassionate declines. So it's a gift to us to actually do some data fasting. And when we do see something that evokes sadness, this kind of a tragic feeling of not being able to cope, to bring it into our heart, whatever practice we have, whether it's prayer, whether it's going for a walk, just take that in our heart and be with it. And that's really a way that we can deepen our compassion instead of shutting down.
Yeah, and I think the things that Jason raises sort of makes it all the more important that we are cultivating and growing compassion, and that returning violent action with violent action is not going to be successful. And so compassion is fierce and strong. It is not a weak force. And I think, you know, it really is incumbent upon us to create a positive contagion for compassion in this society.
We're going to take, go ahead, Sarah.
Well, I just, when I see that, this piece of news about people being hurt by our government, and it's not the first piece of news in the past few months that is like that, mm-hmm. it actually awakens in me compassion. And I think I'm more compassionate because I see that I'm a part of a system that's hurting other people. And if I'm shutting that out or I'm shutting down from that, then I'm even more guilty in that system. If I need to be aware, it doesn't mean I have to be aware at every moment and every day and every time of everything that's going on. But when something, when I see something that I believe is wrong and people are being hurt and I'm a part of that system that's doing that, then the compassion in me should actually give me passion to voice that it's wrong and to use the power that I do have to speak out against it.
We do have to take a quick break, but first, a word about tomorrow's program. We're going to learn about a statewide effort to reduce lung cancer in Maine. If you have comments or questions ahead of time, feel free to email them to talk@mainepublic.org. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do HealthReach, offering primary care and counseling under one roof at 11 locations throughout central and western Maine. HealthReach.org. Skudik Institute, pursuing collaborative solutions to critical environmental challenges through discovery. Support their work at skudikinstitute.org. And Otelco, formerly OTT Communications. From phones to fiber, serving Maine businesses for more than a century. Otelco.com.
On the next Fresh Air, breakthroughs in our understanding of the immune system and how the body fights disease and heals itself, or attacks itself, and how stress, sleep, and state of mind figure into the immune system's functioning. We talk with Daniel M. Davis, author of The Beautiful Cure. He's a professor of immunology at the University of Manchester in the UK. Join us.
You can hear that program this evening at 7 right here on Maine Public Radio. If you love public broadcasting and have experience with philanthropic giving, Maine Public has a position open that may be of interest to you. We're seeking a full-time major gifts coordinator and researcher to join our team, working to ensure a sustainable future for this valued service. If you or someone you know might want more information, please visit mainepublic.org and click on About and then Careers. Thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're learning about compassion and how it affects our lives. Joining me today, Penthea Burns with USM's Children, Youth, and Families Program, Vaishali Momgain with USM Center for Compassion, and Sarah Ewing Merrill with Hope Gateway Church. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Arthur, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Arthur. Go ahead.
Hi. You know, I wanted to, you asked about oddities about compassion. I think people often think that compassion means agreement. Mm. And it doesn't need to mean that at all. When I walk down Congress Street, when the demonstrators are outside Planned Parenthood, I disagree completely with what they're saying, what they're doing, the way that it feels like they're harassing women who are either going for a regular health checkup or perhaps going for an abortion. But the fact that I disagree with them doesn't mean that I can't feel compassion for these people, knowing that they are trying to be faithful to a set of beliefs which are theirs. And it's as if, you know, my head finds me in disagreement with them. My heart connects with them in some way, and that doesn't dilute the disagreement.
Arthur, thank you for your call. And Penthea, I know this is something you wanted to talk about. Compassion is not necessarily agreement.
Yeah, and so oftentimes when we encounter someone we are disagreeing with, we shy away from like wanting to understand or wanting to hear more, and are more focused on thinking about what we want to say than really deeply listening. And if we pause to deeply listen, even to the point where they might be open to hearing what we reflect back, then we can find some kind of common ground without necessarily agreeing, and find some common humanity. So really glad that Arthur raised that today.
Sarah.
Yeah, I think also just avoidance. You know, there's a certain level of, I grew up in South Dakota, and I realized after I moved away from there that there's this South Dakota polite value, which is seen as kind because you don't confront people, you don't say your truth. And my experience of living in New England is not that. People put their stuff on the table and they tell you how it is, and I appreciate that. But it really brings it back to this idea that I comes from the 12-step community, that to be clear is to be kind, to be unclear is to be unkind. Like, if I can tell you what I actually think and speak my truth to you, it's actually kinder and more compassionate than avoiding the conflict that we have, or letting you say your opinion and then me, like, kind of holding it back and in myself and just actually being mad at you because I haven't connected with you in a real way in which we could move forward, like Panthea was saying, like, we can agree on something, or we can at least have had a time when we were honest.
Matthew on Facebook writes, compassion is about listening and begins with respecting that others have different experiences, feelings, and hopes than you do.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right on.
So we'll go to Kimberly, who's calling from Yarmouth. Hi, Kimberly. Go ahead.
Hi. First of all, thank you for tackling this topic. It's really timely, and it's so, so, so very important. And I and my pals are very inspired by the fact that USM is launching a Center for Compassion. It's absolutely needed. The reason I'm calling is because I've heard a physician or two call in, and I don't know that your listeners are aware of a collaboration between Tufts in Boston and Maine Medical Center. Their standardized patient program was launched with the view of encouraging more compassionate behaviors and interactions with patients. It's an experiential training program. It's been going on for over 10 years. I've been part of it for about 7, and that's the primary purpose. And every resident has to go through some degree of standardized patient training before they can get their certifications or begin working with the public. So I have been extremely inspired and gratified by being part of this program. And I'm curious whether your speakers have heard of it before, or if there might be other similar programs that are targeting physician training in particular in our area.
Hi, Kimberly. So this is Vaishali, and thanks for bringing this up. I actually have heard of the Maine Med program. We've been doing workshops at USM where we invite folks, particularly who have sustainable compassion training, to do workshops. And I think there was one in May that we spoke to the person at Maine Med, and they sent 4 of their caregivers over. So there's been some overlap already. But you've tapped into something that's a really rich source, where we're hoping that we can collaborate with area healthcare providers to put some of this training in place, because you mentioned residents being trained with respect to patients. But I've just been reading some pretty horrific statistics about what mental health is like amongst medical students and how much they need this training for themselves. So thank you for reaching out. And please, my information is on the website. Let's connect offline too.
Kimberly, thank you so much for calling. We'll go to Frederick from Bath. Hi, Frederick. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer and guests. I wanted to bring my experience of having practiced, since the mid-90s, the practice of Zen. And it is basically the foundation of what we talk about as far as mindfulness. In the practice of sitting over a longer and longer period of time, if one can take, for instance, 1 week out of one's life to sit in an organized plan with many other people, we actually can develop a less discursive way of thinking. In other words, we can separate. I can separate from my judgments, let's say, around the president's actions and notice them as just simply judgments. But I have been able to develop a more connected way of being with my world, because if I'm not being, if I'm not objectifying everything and making a complaint out of it, I actually see that there's no difference between me and, for instance, the words that I say and looking out at my driveway, because I have developed that that capability of seeing myself in all that I am connected to. Well, really, we're interdependent on the entire ground of being that supports us, and we give thanks even to the next breath, because the next breath is a given. It's a present. It's provided for me.
Frederick, thank you for calling. Sarah?
It just reminds me of being present with one another in prayer. A few weeks ago, one of our members at Hope Gateway shared about her experience of being and living in the community and how the community has shaped and formed her. And she said that praying with other people each time we gather for worship really has changed the way she thinks about conflicts in Africa, because she's prayed with other people about their intimate connection with the conflicts in Africa and their families who are still there suffering. And she thinks differently about people she sees on the street struggling with addiction because she's prayed with people in our community who themselves or their relatives have named their struggle and their recovery from addiction. And she thinks about aging differently. She thinks about parenting differently, that people being open and vulnerable and sharing in prayer and in that space that we've sort of talked about, that pause, that you step back from the reality of your life and you stop seeing with your head and your eyes and you start seeing with your heart, that practice of prayer or meditation and connection and seeing, as the caller said, like seeing that we all are connected and that we all are the same and that we're all beloved children of God and we're all, like, everything is sacred, that we can transform the judgments we have and the fear and the anger that can really drive us.
Mm. Panthea, it looked to me like you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I mean, I think that and how that translates into action, creating opportunities for interdependence, how important it is to both give and receive, so that means that I have to give other people the opportunities to give as well as to receive, so that, you know, in some ways that's a bringing to life or into action some of those prayerful interactions as well.
Yeah.
We'll go to Jeff calling from Walterboro. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, terrific. So I think there's a little bit of imbalance here in the discussion. I hear a lot about practice. I hear a lot about study, and then only little bits and pieces, dribs and drabs, are coming out about action. And so we all saw the pictures this morning of women and children running from tear gas with helicopters above. And I don't know anybody's heart, not knowing what that circumstance is, whose heart wouldn't go out to these young families running. And to know that this is my government representing me doing these things requires me to take action. And my heart knows immediately what that's about. Anybody's would. And so where do we go? What action are you all taking to put this into place? What part of the training is the social effect that you want, besides just dealing with the individual? We have to deal with the society. We have to deal with the community. And for me, I mean, I got my congressperson's phone number and left a message and wrote an email about, this is not my way. This is not the way that I want to be represented by my officials. And I want to know how many of you have done that. What are the concrete actions that you are taking besides the teaching?
Jeff, thank you. And Sarah, you've got a long list of answers to Jeff. But and you did mention before contacting your representative.
Yeah, I think it's the power that we have to connect with our government and to let them know what we believe and what we think they should be doing. And they represent us. They work for us. And so we should be contacting them about everything that we feel passionate about, that causes us to have compassion. And it's hard. It's hard to keep that energy as we were, this fatigue that we all have come to when we sit, tell our government, don't do these things. We don't want you to act like that. This is not the way we want. And we have to do it even if we feel like we're not being heard. Even if we feel like it's not going to make a difference, it's the power that we do have. So we need to do it. We need to speak out. We need to contact our representatives and make our voices heard, even if we're not hopeful that it will change anything, because it transforms us to act.
Hi, Shelley.
Yeah, I think it's really important what you said, Sarah. And Jeff, bravo. I mean, this is exactly what we need to be doing. And the other thing that comes out in droves is one person alone can do only so much. And look, we're a panel here and we are connected. And when we actually connect with other people who feel the same way, it amplifies our voice, our intention. And one of the things I do want to say, and this is in connection with the whole empathic fatigue discussion, is a friend of mine once said that when you sing in a choir, when you have to take a breath, you do so with the trust that the choir is going to keep the note alive. And that's partly the generosity we have to extend to each other in these times when so much requires our heart and our attention.
All right. Benthia, we have a few seconds left, so I want to see if there's something you want to add to what they have said here.
Yeah, just echo that. I think we need to be in regular communication with our congressional representatives, and we need to impact the larger community, because that's who elects those folks, and that our elected officials, I think the leadership comes from people more than it comes from them, and so we really need more people to be able to push on elected officials.
All right. Well, thank you all for being here. The voice you just heard, Benthia Burns, Senior Associate at the Cutler Institute and Muskie School of Public Service at USM. She works with the Children, Youth, and Families Program. Also here, Vaishali Momgain, Associate Professor of Economics at USM and also Director of the new Center for Compassion. And Sarah Ewing Merrill, Co-Pastor of Hope Gateway Church and Executive Director of Greater Portland Family Promise. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.